The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined today by my colleagues, Judge Toth and Judge Falvey. We're convened today via video conference to hear arguments in Jeremy and Maya Badet against Dat P. Tran, the Acting Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 20-4961. Will counsel, beginning with petitioner's counsel, please make your appearance for the record?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Andy LeGalvin on behalf of petitioners Jeremy and Maya Baudet. And with me today is Amanda Pertisati from Public Counsel.
Thank you.
May it please court, representing the secretary, I am Mark McNabb. With me as second chair is Deputy Chief Counsel Joan Moriarty.
Welcome. And Mr. LeGalvin, I understand that you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
We'll make that happen, and you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This case presents the question of whether the statutory right to board review is available for benefits decisions under the caregiver program. And if so, whether the court should utilize the class vehicle to ensure that board review is made available to claimants who were wrongfully deprived of that right prior to a precedential decision in this case. Today, I plan to address a few issues relating to the merits of the case and one issue relating to class certification. On the merits first, the VJRA plainly and unambiguously mandates that board review be made available for all decisions by the secretary under a law that affects the provision of benefits. Now, it is undisputed in this case that the Caregiver Act is a law that affects the provision of benefits. And therefore, by default, board review must be made available as Congress has mandated. The merits issue in this case is resolved by answering two questions. The first is, what is the standard that governs whether Congress has evident sufficient intent to preclude the right to board and judicial review that is provided in the VJRA? And second, whether the secretary has met that standard in this case. Now, this court in Freeman versus Shinseki has already articulated the relevant standard. This court held that in view of the VJRA's express language and the presumption favoring judicial review, nothing short of a clear and explicit bar to board review can suffice to take away the right to board review and the right to judicial review provided by the VJRA. So clear and explicit. The secretary's argument in this case falls far short of that. It relies inherently on implicit inferences. It relies on implicit inferences from statutory text and further implicit inferences from Congress's silence. The secretary's argument is that a single cryptic sentence in the caregiver program statute operates to revoke all review rights provided under the VJRA. Specifically,
Mr. LeGalvin, could I ask you a question? You in this case are not, in this petition, you are not challenging the validity of the regulation 38 CFR 20.104B, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. We are not challenging the validity of the regulation. But that does not mean that the validity of the regulation is irrelevant to this case.
No, I just want to take that piece off the table. So you then, for purposes of this matter, whether or not somebody raises a challenge to that regulation in another matter, but for this matter, we can take that as a given. So you would agree that even on your theory of the case, the problem here is that nothing gets to the board ever, even though there might be situations where the board would determine that question X in a particular veteran caregiver's situation would be precluded from board review under that regulation, right? Am I getting your view correct here?
That is correct, Your Honor, in the sense that right now the door to the board is entirely closed shut and there's no way to get in. And that is correct. So perhaps down the road, when the board starts hearing caregiver claims, perhaps some individual issue may be challenged by the board as being not within its jurisdiction, and someone perhaps could challenge that issue of a bar to review for a medical determination in the sense of challenging the validity of that regulation. But yes, Your Honor, you described it exactly right. The first step, the first impediment to board review in this case is the blanket no board review policy that is currently being implemented.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood that before you went on and you can continue.
Counsel, I have a question. Yes. So does the answer to the jurisdiction question require us to provide an interpretation for the term medical determination?
Your Honor, the short answer is no. The primary question is whether there is a clear and explicit bar to review. And if the court finds that there is no clear and explicit bar to review, if the court finds that the secretary has not met that standard, this court can stop there and find that board review is available, because that's what this case is about. We believe there are alternate constructions of the term medical determination, the likes of which the contours could perhaps be extrapolated down the road through board review and through judicial review in this court once direct appeals start to proceed. But I don't think the court at this juncture would have to, you know, set in stone what that term actually means and what that provision, what impact that provision would have, subsection C1. So it's enough for the court to find that there is not an explicit bar to board review.
Thanks.
Now, as I was saying, the secretary's entire argument rests on this premise that this single sentence that deems certain caregiver program decisions as medical determinations is supposed to be a bar to board and judicial review. Now, to be clear, there is no explicit bar and there is no clear bar to board review or judicial review in the caregiver program statute. And that sentence at subsection C1 is not it either. It simply states that medical determinations or that certain caregiver program decisions are deemed medical determinations. But it doesn't answer the question to what end. To what end are decisions deemed medical determinations, right? What is a medical determination as Congress used it in this context? And what is the effect of a decision being deemed a medical determination? The statute is entirely silent on that. It provides no context as to what the intent of this provision was. There's no definition of the term medical determination. The subheading is under the section titled construction, which provides no indication that it might review to review rights or barring board review rights. The legislative history of the Caregiver Act also provides no indication whatsoever of what this provision means, let alone that Congress intended to include it as a bar to board review. The secretary just simply asserts without any support that this provision, that Congress used this provision and used the term medical determination, and that it was designed to be an implicit reference to a VA regulation that bars board review for medical treatment questions.
So, counsel, I mean, is it possible that C2 shed some light on what C1 means, right? That the medical determination, whether something's a medical determination, basically, whatever that means, it cannot be construed to create any employment relationship or any decision affecting those types of matters.
And you're referring to the no employment provision under C2?
Yes.
Your Honor, I see those two provisions being put under an ancillary subsection of the statute. So I don't see, you know, that I see that those two subsections as sort of being general ancillary provisions that didn't really tie to anything explicitly in the primary sections of the statute. So I don't know if reading them together provides any indication of what subsection C1 could possibly mean,
the use of the term medical determination. I mean, that's really a one-off standalone, even within Title 38. I mean, this isn't something that shows up in other contexts.
No, Your Honor, this is unprecedented. I have not seen one other statute where Congress has said that a provision is a, or a benefit eligibility decision is a medical determination. And in fact, the only other context in which Congress has done what the Secretary claims Congress is doing with the caregiver program is the Veterans Community Care Program, which is codified at 38 U.S.C. 1703. And it didn't use language like deeming eligibility decisions to be a medical determination. When Congress wanted to bar the right to board review there, Congress just simply said it in a sentence. There's no right to board review under this program. It didn't use sort of a word puzzle game with the Secretary to see if the Secretary can say explicitly what Congress for some reason decided not to say explicitly. And that's what's being argued here. Again, if Congress wants to bar the right to board review, it knows how to use that language. And the Veterans Community Care Program shows a really perfect example of that. So yes, to answer your question, Your Honor, I have not seen a situation where Congress has deemed decisions to be medical determinations as an attempt to take away the right to board review. And really that would be unprecedented, right? Because Congress legislates with the backdrop of the VJRA, and it is presumed to know that there is a presumption favoring judicial review. And it knows, Congress knows that it has to be explicit if it wants to bar the right to judicial review or the right to board review. Congress knows this, and so it doesn't speak in vague terms. As the Supreme Court noted, Congress doesn't put elephants in mouse holes. If Congress wants to fundamentally change a fundamental aspect of a regulatory scheme, it doesn't put those provisions or those mandates in vague terms or in ancillary provisions. And I can't think of a more ancillary provision than the construction section of a statute. And so all presumptions and standards weigh heavily against the Secretary's argument here. And I want to briefly address the Secretary's ratification argument. The Secretary essentially says, putting aside, the standard of clear and explicit and whether that is evident on the face of the statute or in the legislative history, put all that aside. We as in the Secretary have now interpreted this provision, and Congress should be deemed to have silently ratified it or silently approved of it by enacting the VA Mission Act. Now, it's important to note that the ratification canon is not just some vehicle through which agency interpretations are just simply allowed to slip through the cracks at the halls of Congress. It's not an end run around legislation. The touchstone is congressional approval. So at a minimum, the ratification canon requires evidence of widespread congressional awareness of the agency's interpretation. And then second, it requires some affirmative act directed to the specific provision at issue. So either a ratification or a reenactment of the specific provision, an amendment of the specific provision, something to indicate that Congress had this specific provision on its mind. And it has to be under circumstances that indicate Congress approved of the agency's interpretation. The Secretary appears to treat the ratification canon as just a two-step presumption process. You first, without any evidence, just presume that Congress knows the law. And then second, you just presume that Congress approves. But that's not how this canon has been applied in the courts. It has teeth, right? You actually have to show evidence of widespread congressional knowledge and evidence of approval on the part of Congress. So if we apply that standard here, if you look through the VA Mission Act or the VA Mission Act's legislative history, of which there are thousands and thousands of pages, you will not see one single comment relating to this provision, nor will you see a comment relating to the Secretary's interpretation, any acknowledgement, let alone approval. It's entirely absent in the VA Mission Act. The VA Mission Act didn't even relate to this specific provision. The VA Mission Act was primarily concerned with expanding the program to pre-9/11 veterans and making other ancillary changes, but it didn't reenact or amend or devote any attention to this particular provision. This is a fundamental requirement of ratification, and it's absent. If the touchstone is for ratification is congressional approval, it's entirely missing here. And it's also important to note that the ratification canon is at its lowest ebb when the agency's interpretation would work a conflict with the existing statutory scheme. And here we have the VJRA that plainly mandates board appeals on all benefits decisions. And we have an interpretation that's supposed to be ratified by Congress silently without any approval that takes away that right. The ratification canon isn't analyzed in a vacuum without regard to the other statutory canons that would apply. The touchstone standard here is there has to be a clear and explicit bar to board review.
So, counsel, I understand your argument that you know, for you to prevail on the jurisdictional question, we need not expressly define medical determination, right? I mean, I think, but that said, if you had to hazard a guess as to what Congress meant by this sort of unusual term, what do you think?
I think a very plausible explanation for this provision is that what Congress was saying is that these eligibility decisions under the caregiver program are medical determinations in the sense that they must be supported by medical evidence. Not that they're not allowed to go to the board, but it was an instruction to this court, to the board, to litigants, to claimants, that the eligibility decisions under the caregiver program must be established with medical evidence as opposed to lay evidence, right? Because this court and the board has repeatedly used that term. You know, the term medical determination isn't only used in the regulatory context, in the board review bar context. It's used by this court to describe just that, decisions that must be supported by medical evidence. It's in the Colvin line of cases, and there are hundreds of decisions from this court using that precise term to describe exactly that, decisions that must be supported by medical evidence as opposed to lay evidence. And it's entirely plausible that Congress was simply instructing that these decisions during review, which assumes the right to board review as is required by the VJRA, these decisions must be supported by medical evidence, whether to grant or deny benefits. It must be supported by medical evidence. And it's not as though this would be surplusage, right? Or that there's no need for Congress to make this clear, because if you look at the caregiver program eligibility requirements, it's not entirely clear that these decisions must be supported by medical evidence. If you take, for example, the eligibility criteria of whether a veteran is in need of personal care services in order to engage in activities of daily living. I mean, we all engage in activities of daily living. It doesn't require you could probably describe to me what your injuries are, and I don't have any medical background. I have no medical degree or anything, and I could probably reasonably shoot from the hip with pretty good aim as to whether you can engage in activities of daily living just based on my own common knowledge and experience. But Congress did not want that. Congress wanted these eligibility decisions to be based on medical evidence, not lay evidence, not individual members of the board shooting from the hip, bringing to bear their common knowledge of what a veteran can do with one leg, what a veteran can do if one eye is missing. That's what Congress wanted to prevent. So I think it's equally plausible that that provision, subsection C1, was simply mandating that Congress or that this court and the board should treat these decisions as medical determinations in the sense that they must be supported by medical evidence. And we are approaching here an ambiguity, right? A statutory ambiguity. And, you know, even putting aside the you know, Freeman standard, the presumption favoring judicial review, the presumption against implied repeal, just the pro-veteran canon, interpretive doubt should be resolved in favor of the veterans here. And there's no doubt and no dispute on the Secretary's side that an interpretation that preserves the right to board review, preserves the right to judicial review, fundamental pieces of the VA structure, would be a pro-veteran interpretation. Now, Your Honor, I do want to finish up briefly with class certification. The Secretary only really meaningfully disputes one element of class certification, and that's Rule 22A3, the superiority factor. And it probes the question of whether class relief would serve the interests of justice to a greater degree than would simply issuing a precedential decision. Now, before digging into the standard and how that applies to this case, I think it's worth noting what is and what is not at issue in this case. If a precedential decision in this case confirms the right to board review, we don't have any doubt that future program caregiver program claims will be given that board review. We don't doubt that the Secretary will apply a precedential decision to future caregiver program claims. And by that, I mean a caregiver program claim filed the day after a precedential decision. When that claim runs its course, we don't doubt the Secretary will give the right to board review. What we have trouble with, however, is whether the Secretary is going to take steps following a precedential decision to ensure that individuals who have already exhausted the VHA appeals process and should have been given the right to board review, whether those individuals will be given the right to board review, as would, you know, if this court were to find that board review is available for the caregiver program. And this is the proposed class that we're proposing here. These are individuals who have already exhausted the VHA appeals process and should have been given the right to board review, but have not. And we call these individuals past claimants, but that's a misnomer. And in reality, these are pending claims. These are claimants who have not been given a proper notice under 38 USC 5104A, which requires a benefits notice to identify the appropriate next steps or the next potential appeal rights that the claimant may have. These are individuals who have either been told they have, you know, have not been told they have the right to board review or have been told affirmatively they do not have the right to board review, right? So these are pending claims in the true sense of that term. And In Re Fee Agreement of Cox confirms that an individual who has not been given a proper statement of appeal rights as is required by the statute, those claims are still open. No statutory period has begun to run for those claims. They're still awaiting their notice. So the reality is, for this case, there should be no need for a class certification. What should happen is a precedential decision should issue from this court confirming the right to board review, and the VA should just simply apply that to pending claims as all precedential decisions would do. All precedential decisions apply to pending claims, and that's essentially what these individuals are in the proposed class. But the Secretary has made clear
–
Judge Allen.
Sorry, you'd think after a year at Zoom, I'd learn how to put my microphone on. If the Secretary agreed with that, you would agree that that's the only reason to have a class here, is if the court needed to compel the Secretary, assuming you're right on the quote merits issue here, the jurisdictional merits issue. If the Secretary said, well, yeah, if we lose, they're all still open and they got to be given a appellate, but that's the only thing here that in your view separates or necessitates, in your view, the need for a class versus a precedential opinion.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And I assume that would include not just a a confirmation that those individuals would be entitled to review, or in this example, we're talking as though the secretary and I are stipulating two terms and presenting it to the court. If the secretary were to confirm that those individuals were entitled or are entitled to the right to board review, and then further are given notice, whether notice just because it's equitable to do so, and that's something that should be part of the relief through the class vehicle, or just notice because they're statutorily entitled to notice, or at the very least just to trigger some definite, you know, appeal period, appeal window. I mean, just to start the statutory period running, if it were to include notice as well, then I would agree with that, Your Honor, that confirmation plus notice would resolve the class issues in this case.
Because you view, and I think this is correct if you buy all of the arguments up to this point, that none of these claims, because as far as I can tell, although I'll ask the secretary, I don't think any of these claims have ever been given the paperwork necessary to get to the board. So they would all still be pending. And you can finish answering my question.
That's exactly my understanding, Your Honor. As far as I am aware, each individual as part of the proposed class has not been given paperwork, let alone notice of how to initiate a board claim, because there's simply been a blanket policy of no board review for the caregiver program.
And I'd be happy to give you a couple more minutes if you need it. It sounded like you were about at the end of your argument, but let me know.
No, Your Honor, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, and thank you very much.
Judge Toth, do you have any questions?
I don't, thanks.
Judge Falvey?
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. McNabb, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court? By regulation, a medical determination is not reviewable by the board. This is undisputed. By statute, a determination under the caregiver program shall be considered a medical determination. This is undisputed. Accordingly, PCAFC determinations are not reviewable by the board. Petitioner asked the court to construe Congress's instruction of how to construe the statute creating and governing this program in a way that robs the text of any reasonable meaning, and the secretary asked the court to reject this invitation to expand the court's jurisdiction, I'm sorry, the board's jurisdiction to matters reserved from it by Congress.
Mr. McNabb, why wouldn't Congress have made our job easier and the agency's position easier by saying such decisions may not be appealed to the Board of Veterans Appeals? Congress used that exact language in the Veterans Community Care Program at 38 U.S.C. 1703F. And that seems pretty explicit. And so I just don't understand why Congress would decide to do something as important as this, meaning preclude all review at the board and thereby all review in courts, whether our court or any other court, by making us connect dots when it clearly knows how to say no review.
Well, Your Honor, you're right. The Congress could have said this differently, but what they did say was that these matters shall be construed as medical determinations. And so the decision they reached, Congress reached, was that these matters should be handled in the way the secretary handles medical determinations. Since 1983, by regulation, then 19.3b, medical determinations are beyond the review of the board. That regulation was reworded and moved after the creation of this court, but remains in effect. That medical determinations, the agency has determined, are things that are beyond the jurisdiction of the board. And so what Congress has decided was not explicitly that these matters are not for the board. What they've determined is that these matters should be handled the way that medical determinations are handled by the secretary. And this longstanding regulation, which has not been challenged, explains how medical determinations are beyond the jurisdiction of the board.
So in your brief, you seem to suggest, the secretary seemed to suggest that this wasn't categorical, that there would be some things that would be non-medical determinations as related to this program. Is that, did I understand your position correctly?
No, Your Honor. Our view is that any decision by the secretary under this section, under the program, affecting the furnishing of assistance or support shall be considered a medical determination.
So the furnish and support and all of that.
Yes.
You said something in your brief that suggested that there would be things that could potentially get to the board. If I misread that, that's fine. So then is it the secretary's position that this is simply categorical?
Yes, Your Honor. The Baudet's case and any case, I don't think anyone has presented here a situation where the decision under the program would not affect the furnishing of assistance or support. And so any such decision is a medical determination by mandate of Congress. And it did so in the context of longstanding agency statement via regulation that matters that are medical determinations are beyond the jurisdiction of the board.
So for instance, what if the deciding factor was the caregiver's eligibility, just whether the caregiver met the definition of 71.30, period, no medical piece to it beyond that. That would be a medical determination.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that what Congress decided was that these matters would be decided in one place, and they would be decided in a way that the secretary adjudicates medical determinations, and that is that they are beyond the jurisdiction of the board and that they are to be appealed through the clinical appeals process.
But even, you know what, as I look at 20.104B, right, I mean, the second part of it defines medical determinations, but the first provides a list of things that the board discusses, you know, the need for boards, you know, jurisdiction, eligibility for hospitalization, outpatient treatment, nursing home, domiciliary care, right? I mean, devices, whether someone's eligible for prosthetics, canes. I mean, right, whether somebody should get a prosthetic, orthopedic shoes strikes me as having a little bit of a medical, there's a kind of medical core to that question. And yet the reg sort of distinguishes that from what would be purely medical determinations.
Yes, Your Honor. The regulation leaves, provides examples, and these matters have been litigated and adjudicated and litigated here. And so there are cases like King and Meacham where the court looked at whether something was a medical determination or not. And so we believe that what Congress did here was to tell us that we don't need to determine whether the descriptions or the examples apply in 20.104B. That is, they placed the entirety of this program in decisions that affect the furnishing of assistance or benefits under the program squarely on the side of being medical determinations, so that these questions are not open for interpretation. They've told us how to construe the statute. Well,
but if there were two plausible readings of them, right? One is that even though Congress knows how to say there is no jurisdiction, it decided in this program to not mention that at all and accomplish that goal by sub silentio referring to a regulation that pre-existed judicial review in order to cut off judicial review. That's option one. And option two is that Congress meant to signal to the adjudicators at the agency that these things had to be supported by medical evidence, right? In the world in which we have to have this clear statement to prohibit review, why wouldn't we say, all right, Congress, you can do this, but if you're presenting two potential options, the position that says we're not going to lightly disfavor judicial or cutting off judicial review, you just haven't been clear enough. I mean, why wouldn't that be a plausible way to read this?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that this is clear, that medical determinations have been determined by the agency to be beyond the jurisdiction of the board, and that Congress determined that all decisions under this program are medical determinations. And and there must be, that must be given effect. And what does that mean? It means, pursuant to an unchallenged regulation, if they are medical determinations, and under an unchallenged regulation, medical determinations are beyond the jurisdiction of the board, then they did clearly state that these matters are not within the jurisdiction of the board, but they did so in a way that puts them, that gives them to the secretary and handles them in a way that the secretary determines that medical determinations are appropriately handled. So they do not need to clearly say these are beyond the board. What they've said is these are medical determinations with the clear knowledge of what the secretary views and what the law is regarding the fact that medical determinations are beyond the jurisdiction of the board.
And so it is the secretary's position then that anything that, so for example, if somebody qualifies as a family member, that it's okay for Congress to say that's a medical determination?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that it is for Congress to decide how this statute should be construed. It did so in the construction.
But that sort of reminds me of, the Abraham Lincoln closing argument where he says, a dog has five legs if you say a tail is a leg. But of course, a tail isn't a leg. I mean, so my point being, it could have been a policy determination by Congress to say we're creating this massive new program and we don't want those men and women in black robes to have anything to do with it. And so no judicial review. But wouldn't it be truly bizarre for Congress to try to accomplish that by saying whether you're a family member is a medical determination? Because there is no construction in the world where that is not an arbitrary idea. Because you could imagine hypotheticals where determining whether somebody is a family member would require a medical determination. But you probably agree with me that 99.9%, it's not a medical determination.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe the intent of Congress here was that questions like that, or questions like dates of service or matters that that Congress determined should be adjudicated along with the entirety of the issue. And that should be adjudicated.
So for dates of service, for example, right? So under the original program, having to come after 9/11, right? Yes. And I mean this question quite sincerely. Did VA go out and obtain a medical opinion from a doctor or nurse or other practitioner as to the date of service? I mean, did they treat Congress's words then as saying, well, I can't look at the DD-214 and say that he or she served after 9/11 because it's a medical determination and I'm not competent to do that, so I'm going to go get a medical determination on that? Did you treat it that way?
No, Your Honor, and that is the absurd, that petitioners asked for that absurd outcome, because what their one alternative take is that Congress may have meant the Colvin Doctrine. They may have meant to apply the Colvin Doctrine, but under their reading, if Congress meant to apply the Colvin Doctrine to decisions, it would mean so for the entirety of the decision. So in fact, the question as you phrased it is if you were meant to apply the Colvin Doctrine, but we don't believe that's what Congress intended, and we think it's clear that what Congress intended was that these are medical determinations, and that therefore what flows from that is the application of 20.104B, which is to put them beyond the jurisdiction of the board. So petitioners have presented only one potential alternative meaning for medical determinations. They assert that when creating the PCFC, they may have intended the Colvin rule. We think that that doesn't make sense for a couple of reasons. First, as we note in our pleading, Colvin does not mention the term medical determination. Anytime the court referred to something that the board did as a medical determination, under their reading, it would also mean that pursuant to 20.104B, that matter was beyond the board. Well, clearly the use of that terminology in cases can't have meant that, because what flows from something being a medical determination is beyond the board's jurisdiction altogether. Colvin simply precludes the board from refuting expert conclusions or evidence about medical matters with its own non-expert opinion. It's a question about competence, and it's a question about weighing of the evidence. That would be entirely unnecessary to put that in the statute. because if these matters were reviewed by the board and the court, the Colvin Doctrine would naturally apply where it applies. So the only alternative provided here, the only alternative reading is Colvin, but the Colvin, that would make it superfluous. It would be entirely unnecessary for this provision to exist, to say, follow the Colvin Law Board. Well, that's, they're bound by that in any case. But when they say something's a medical determination, we believe that has a specific meaning, and that 20.104B explains that all medical determinations are beyond the jurisdiction of the board. And that is what must flow from this provision in the statute. And so, for instance, if it wasn't superfluous, which we believe it is, then it would be nonsensical, because then the outcome would be that the board would have to do what you were just explaining, which is, if Congress told them these are medical determinations, but we really intended for the board to be looking at them, then the board would have to get a medical opinion about date of service or family members.
Yeah, of course, it's also possible that the words medical determination in the statute, the caregiver statute, and the word medical determination as defined in the regulation, they're the same words, but they don't necessarily have the same meaning, because of course we do have a situation now where some things are medical determinations in the sense that they are precluded from review. You know, I want brand name drug, not generic drug, as an example. While other things are medical determinations in the way Colvin and its line of cases, and I agree with you, Colvin doesn't use that term, but cases after Colvin describe Colvin using the term medical determination. So they don't have to be exactly the same, right?
Well, Your Honor, we just believe that those cases are not, they don't accurately reflect what Colvin is about, because it's not a clinical decision. You know, these are questions of what types of evidence are necessary, but that is not the case here. For instance, in the regulation that regarding eligibility, in both the new and the old versions, the question, one necessary question here is whether participating in the program is, quote, in the best interest of the veteran. That's and it's described in the older version of the criteria as a clinical criteria, a list of clinical criteria. We believe that this program is clearly, one that's medical in nature. It's determining how best to treat a veteran. And so in doing so, you know, those types of questions can, under 20.104B, fall on one or another side of the line, as 24.10B defines it and provides examples more specifically. But we believe that what Congress did here fairly clearly is that it said we don't need to make those kinds of decisions. You don't need to look at the Caregiver Act individual decisions and determine whether they are more like examples in 20.104B or not. What they said is, this is a medical determination. And that has a meaning, and what must flow from that is that we don't need to determine what the definition of, or we don't have to interpret it in the context of the examples given by 20.104B, because Congress has told us these are that type of decision, and 20.104B tells us that type of decision is beyond the jurisdiction of the board.
So let me ask this. Let's say hypothetically, I agree with everything you say, that Congress, this is exactly what they meant with medical determination, and they're going to remove it from review. Would there still be maybe procedural due process issues? Because that's a constitutional issue, that, you know, the defect would be on Congress for not, you know, they're providing benefits to somebody and then terminating them really with no due process.
Well, Your Honor, we don't think that would be the case. I mean, there would be notice, there would be an opportunity to participate and respond and be heard on multiple levels. So this clinical appeal exists just for this purpose, to handle medical determinations. And again, these are clinical in nature. You pointed out 1720G, its other provisions. I think one of the points there is that in 1720G C2B, it notes that nothing in this section creates entitlement to assistance or support. So that makes clear that this is a forward-looking kind of treatment-oriented question, and not a question of, what are the veterans' losses? How do we compensate for those? There's a separate program for that. This is about how best to treat the veteran. And Congress determined, I think rightly, that these are medical determinations. And those types of determinations are handled by a multi-level clinical appeal process in which the veteran participates, and in this case did participate, rather than being sent to the board. The medical determinations are determined to be beyond the jurisdiction of the board and are in fact handled by another appropriate process that involves medical practitioners at every level, specialists who understand the questions, who can look at whether the best interest of the veteran in this treatment context is best accomplished by one means or not. And we believe that Congress was right, but nonetheless, that Congress did mandate that these are medical determinations because of the nature of the program. And it's consistent with the nature of the program that Congress decided to determine to have these matters adjudicated in the way that VA does adjudicate medical determinations.
If we were to disagree with you, Mr. McNabb, and say that, well, there are some components of this that are precluded by the regulation, not everything is, and so notices should go to the board. People should be able to go to the board. This goes to the class certification point. If we were to rule in that way, what is the VA's position with respect to the claims of all of those folks out there for whom appellate rights were either not provided or affirmatively told they could not appeal? What would VA's position be in that context?
Your Honor, if you held that these folks did have a right to appeal to the board, then naturally, that would be the case. I can't speak to what.
No. I just want to be precise. My fault. There are two things. There's the future, right? People who haven't yet been removed from the program or haven't yet applied. Clearly, I have no doubt that the secretary would comply with a precedential decision of the court that says these are appealable. Right? For those cadre of people who have been removed from the program or denied, and in the past, they weren't provided appellate rights. And if we said they should have been, then those claims would have been remained open because they never would have been provided. With that cadre, the past people, for lack of a better way to put it, what would VA do, if anything, with respect to that group?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that you are correct in saying that the clock would not have run or begun to run on their right to appeal to the board. And so without proper notice, then a future appeal would be timely. I can't say whether secretary would then go back and start the clock for everyone by giving them notice or whether it would simply accept, appeals to the board that came in.
And that's fair. That's fair because you're here representing the secretary, but then I just want to make sure I'm exactly right. If we get to this level, that the secretary can't take a position today that you would affirmatively do something like you did in the wake of the Staub case, which was mail out notices. Now, I know that there were issues with the notices that were mistakes, but we're not getting into the Staub world today, right? But VA proactively took that position. You're just not able to tell us that you would or wouldn't.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I do agree with you that that if you held that they had such a right and they'd not been provided a notice of such a right, then that the time to exercise that right would not run until such a notice was received.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, the secretary asks the court to dismiss the appeal based on the interplay between two clear laws. By regulation, a medical determination is not reviewable by the board. It's beyond the board's jurisdiction. We think that's clear. It's unopposed and must be given force. And this isn't a question where we look to 20.104B for guidance. We determine whether this is or isn't a medical determination. Congress made clear that these matters, must be construed as medical determinations, and we think that one thing flows from that, and that's application of 20.104B as placing these matters beyond the jurisdiction of the board. That was the clear intent of Congress, And so, given that by statute, the determinations under the PCAFC are beyond the jurisdiction of the board, the petition should be dismissed because it seeks the right to appeal that that Congress has indicated is not present in this case. Rather, these matters are handled as medical determinations are mattered with a multi-layer specialist clinical appeals process that the veteran had access to.
Thank you, Mr. McNabb. Judge Toth, do you have any questions?
I don't, thanks.
Judge Falvey?
I do not, thank you.
Thank you, and we'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I don't have too much to add other than just a brief comment on notice. Putting aside the question of whether the secretary will concede that these are pending claims who are entitled to a right to board review and no statutory period has gone forward, we now, there is a very pressing need to provide notice to these individuals in view of the chilling effect that prior notices or prior lack of notices or any statement that says your decision is final and cannot be reviewed, you have no right to go to the board. There's a very real need to let these individuals know that their rights are now restored, right? That there is now, it has now been confirmed by a precedential decision that you are entitled to the right to appeal to the board to correct that chilling effect that previously had been given in view of prior notices. So that's one thing I just want to press on is that even if there is a concession that these, there really is, there's no need to order, the court wouldn't have to order the secretary to start accepting board appeals. There is just at the very least a need to inform these individuals of their rights to do so. And with that, Your Honor, that's all I have.
Do either Judge Toth or Judge Falvey have any questions?
I do not.
I do very briefly. In response to the Secretary's point that you've offered no alternative interpretation other than medical determination must refer to Colvin, the use of medical determination in the statute doesn't refer to this, to the regulation and doesn't refer to Colvin, what does it mean? What's it referring to?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I first want to note that until there is an actual ripe controversy to demand an answer on that, I don't think the court absolutely has to answer it in this case. Because the primary question is there a right to go to the board in the first instance? And with that resolved, I don't think there's any need to actually answer the question. But that's not to say that we don't think that, we call it the Colvin interpretation, is a viable and plausible interpretation. And I did want to make a comment on the Colvin interpretation. We call it the Colvin interpretation, but really it's not, it's not, the idea isn't to be an express incorporation of Colvin. Colvin is just a consequence of a decision being deemed a medical determination. So the whole point is it should be, eligibility decisions should be treated as medical determination. And one consequence of that is that the Colvin protections that the board is prohibited from just making a decision on those based on its own opinion, and that if it wants to do so, it has to resort to independent medical evidence in the record. So I just want to make clear that it's not just that, it's just Colvin. It's that these are medical determinations. They're decisions that must be supported by evidence. But to answer your question, Your Honor, we're a bit at a loss on what this determination means. And if anything, it counsels against the secretary's argument because, we didn't lodge with the court all of the legislative histories that we pulled on these acts, but we did. We commissioned comprehensive legislative history reports, thousands and thousands of pages on both the Caregiver Act and the VA Mission Act in the hopes that we could get some clarity on this. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that there is not a word of comment as to what this provision means, right? And that has to weigh against taking away the right to board review rather than in favor of it. And so if I had to venture a further guess outside of, just an instruction to this court, to the board, to litigators, to claimants, that these are decisions that must be based on medical evidence, outside of that, perhaps it could have been a reference to, an acknowledgement that this is a program that's going to necessarily require, doctors to be involved. And that may start to overlap to some extent with your treatment. And if you have a treatment dispute within your claims process for caregiver benefits, you're entitled to go to the board with your caregiver eligibility dispute, but that doesn't mean that you get to bring disputes of medical treatment questions to the board. So it's actually the exact opposite of what the secretary is proposing to give to that construction. But again, there is no support at all for any interpretation. We are all here left guessing and grasping at straws and reading tea leaves as to what this provision might possibly mean.
I seem to recall that. Go ahead, Judge Allen.
I was just going to ask Dawn to put 2 more minutes on the clock just so we can keep ourselves somewhat honest, but take as much time as you both need.
I seem to recall that there was something in the legislative history that the VA responded to a question from Congress about the meaning of this, or at least asking for some level of comfort as to what would be the appeal rights of someone subject to the Caregiver Act and the medical determinations made under it. You all didn't find that in your legislative history review? Go ahead.
Yeah, you were going to answer the question. It is not in the legislative history of either the Caregiver Act, because that was a standalone hearing that occurred after enactment of the act. The enactment was in 2010. That hearing occurred in 2011. And then the VA Mission Act occurred in 2018. And nowhere in the VA Mission Act legislative history is there any discussion of the interpretation that particular VA representative articulated to the 12 House members of the Health Subcommittee in 2011. And even if that committee report somehow found its way into the VA Mission Act legislative history, which it did not, it wasn't a part of it, the Supreme Court has still, mandated that these ratification arguments, these acquiescence and ratification canons, require evidence of widespread congressional knowledge. So, and in SEC versus Sloan, the Supreme Court found that a single subcommittee report where an agency is articulating an interpretation is not enough to put the entire Congress as a whole on notice of what an interpretation is, not for purposes of ratification. It requires something more. And in particular, similar to that case where the interpretation would work to take away rights that are already vested by a prior enactment. And so you need something more there.
Yeah, you would think, though, that after being advised of the secretary's interpretation of that, when they revised the legislation after that, they would have done something to fix that, since this was the cognizant committee, I think. That this communication was too. But I want to ask one other question before I cut you loose here. You said this is an approaching an ambiguity, and therefore we should turn to the veterans canon and interpret in favor of the veteran. Doesn't that skip the step where we're to defer to the secretary's permissible construction?
No, Your Honor, because there are several reasons why deference is not accorded in this case. The first and perhaps foremost is the secretary has not asserted any claim to deference. There, and that's in two briefs filed in this court, not one claim that it's entitled to deference in its interpretation. So perhaps I haven't dug into this, but perhaps there's a waiver or forfeiture of a claim for deference. And second, this is perhaps the reason why deference isn't claimed, is there is no gap-filling role when it comes to determining what issues are allowed to go to the board and what are not. The statutory framework is clear.
Yeah, I think that's Mr. McNabb's argument that there is no ambiguity. You're the one who brought up that it was bordering on ambiguity or was approaching ambiguity. Perhaps that's why there's no argument in the secretary's brief, because this is your argument that you were making. If you were making the argument that the statute is ambiguous, shouldn't our next step be to look to see if there is a permissible interpretation construction by the secretary?
I think maybe I wasn't clear enough. When I say the statutory framework is clear, I'm not referring to subsection C1. I'm referring to section 7104A, which mandates that board appeals be made available for all decisions under a law that affects the provision of benefits. That is clear. And this court held in Wages that the secretary cannot promulgate a regulation that can take away a right created by that statute. So there is no deference that can be accorded to the secretary when it comes to interpreting, review rights under the VJRA. And so I stand by the fact that subsection C1 is ambiguous. I'm by no means saying that provision is clear, far from it. But the statutory framework for review rights is clear. And in that case, in that circumstance, there is no entitlement to deference. And even if we were, veering into the land of deference, the statutory canons that are relevant here, as articulated in Freeman, which is the presumption in favor of judicial review and the presumption that, Congress doesn't impliedly abrogate rights in the VJRA, it has to be explicit, those canons apply at step one. Those are, under Chevron step one, you first see if Congress's intent is clear, applying the traditional tools of statutory interpretation. And once you apply those canons at step one, if there is a lingering ambiguity, only then do you go to step two. And with these particular canons, there are presumptions and they control if they're not rebutted, right? So if the secretary cannot rebut the presumption favoring judicial review with a clear and explicit statement, that's the end of the matter. Chevron leaves the stage. There's no need to go any further into deference when the statutory question is resolved at step one. And even if we were to get into step two, this wouldn't be a Chevron deference circumstance. At best, this would be a Skidmore deference. This is statements in rulemaking, not a promulgated regulation. And it's not as though Congress or the secretary provided some analysis or some support. The secretary just parroted the statute and then said what Congress meant was a bar to board review. And it didn't have any analysis, no legislative history, no anything that got there. So it's not as though there's some detailed analysis that this court can say, the agency knows best here. It's just based on nothing other than the two words, medical determination.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court wants to thank the parties for the very helpful arguments this morning, as well as the briefs. And I want to acknowledge the four organizations who submitted amici briefs in this case. They were very helpful and the court appreciates that. And with that, the matter is submitted for decision. Thank you.
Court is in recess.